Alexander, let's discuss the big antitrust lawsuit, the U.S. Department of Justice against Google, and they're accusing it's a landmark lawsuit. I think it's we haven't seen anything this big since Microsoft. And the Department of Justice on Tuesday filed the lawsuit against Google. It accuses the tech giant of illegally holding monopolies in search and search advertising. It was a year-long investigation. It looked at Google's anti-competitive practices, and it looked at how Google violated antitrust laws to act as a gatekeeper to the internet. It said that the company unlawfully blocked out competitors. It reached deals with phone makers like Apple and Samsung to block out those competitors, to be preset on those massive device manufacturers, Apple and Samsung. And it also reached deals to become the default search engine on those devices as well. And the Department of Justice is also saying that Google abused the dominance of its Android operating system. It strong-armed a lot of manufacturers to preload a lot of its apps, and so it got a leg up on competition on that end as well. So in essence, very much like how Microsoft was leveraging the dominance of Windows, Google has leveraged the dominance of Google Search to push out competitors and rig the market to become an outright monopoly, which I think I'm positive no one would argue the fact that they are a monopoly.
To all intents and purposes, that is exactly what Google is. It has become that over the last 10, 20 years, but it is a monopoly. I mean, there may be a few search engines out there which a small number of people use, but Google has managed, in effect, to push them all out to the fringes. So it is the absolute dominant search engine. And according to this antitrust prosecution, which the Justice Department is bringing, of which, by the way, none of us is surprised, can I make that point too? It has acted to use this dominant position as a search engine, this overwhelmingly dominant position as a search engine, to leverage itself into dominant positions in all other things. And this is exactly what monopolies do. Monopolies always, in the end, act like this. They always claim at the beginning that they're simply providing a good service, that they're providing economies of scale, that they're more efficient, that they're, you know, that this is a, if you like, a natural monopoly. You often hear that said in these sort of defenses that, you know, that it's the most effective and efficient and cost effective and beneficial to the consumer type of operation. But when you actually strip away behind all those arguments, what you tend to find is a very ruthless company using its position in a very, very ruthless way. You're quite right. Microsoft was like this. And if you go back further, all the way back to the great Standard Oil antitrust actions before the First World War, you will find essentially the same thing. So it's taken perhaps rather longer for this to catch up with Google than some of us might have expected, but it's come. And I think this is obviously an immense event. It's going to transform the information technology world, but I think it's also the beginning of more things to come, because Google is obviously the biggest of all the technology companies, the most powerful, the most dominant. But if you're going to pursue antitrust and monopoly suits against Google, then I would say it's only a question of time before you do the same with Facebook, before you do the same with some of the others. So it's come, it's taken a long time. I'm sure the recent political events have played a triggering role, but it has to be said, it was inevitable if these antitrust laws that the United States pioneered mean anything.
Yeah, I mean, it was year-long in the making, they said, but I agree. I think it was inevitable. Google brought a lot of attention onto itself by doing what it did, especially with with the actions that YouTube takes, but Google as well. Google search shadow bans, and it suppresses information, and you know it brought a lot of unnecessary attention to its practices, which it shouldn't have done. And I chalk that up to just very, very bad management. I mean, for such a massive company, it's obvious that Google has very poor management, or at least management that is ideologically possessed and not looking after the business itself.
Well, I'm going to just discuss something about our own experience, and my own particular experience, which is that when we were writing articles, it used to be very straightforward. I would just, you know, look up an article of my own. I would type the title, put my name, put the Duran on Google, and the article would appear. And then a point suddenly came, and it was literally from one day to the next, when that stopped happening. And my articles, your articles, our articles were perfectly, you know, legitimate opinion articles. We did lots of good analytical reporting. There was nothing there that, you know, was in any way, you know, objectionable or offensive. Obviously, we had our opinions, but we were entitled to our opinions. They were always fact-based. They were always well-sourced. The fact that they were becoming increasingly difficult to access was entirely the result, I feel, of an ideological bias. I am sorry to say, but to put it as simply as that, but that was that's absolutely my view. And of course, what happened to us was very slight compared to what has happened to lots of other people. I mean, we've had difficulty finding our own things in, you know, the quick way that we once did, but other people have had many but greater problems than we have done. So ideology is clearly what was driving it. Politics was what was driving it. Partisan allegiances were what were driving it. And business is clearly not what was driving it. So there was no business logic in what Google was doing. And I would say that this is characteristic of monopolies again. That, you know, if you follow the story of monopolies, sooner or later, the temptation to abuse their power, to aggrandize, to gain more and more control, and to play God becomes irresistible. So that's what's happened.
Yeah, and I think nothing displays that better than when Trump beat Hillary Clinton and Google actually had that town hall. And Sergey Brin was there, the founder, and pretty much all the top management was there. And basically, it was a town hall to talk about the election and how they were not happy with the results and how they would rig the election in 2020. That was pretty much the purpose of the town hall. It was a very amateurish move, a very dumb move. Once again, for a company the caliber of Google, it was extremely stupid to do something like that. If I was a major shareholder of Google, for example, I would have been on the phone to the CEO, to the upper management, to Sergey Brin or to Larry Page of Alphabet, and I would have been just screaming at them. I would have just ripped their ear off, literally, because I would have said, "What the hell are you guys doing? What, this is a business, not a feel-good session or a psychological, you know, I don't even know what the hell that was. I don't even have the words to explain it, but I would have been furious."
Well, exactly. Well, it was Google playing God. They were deciding, you know, that they were going to play a crucial and critical role in deciding who the president of the United States was going to be, which is not the purpose of a business. A business is not there to, you know, make electoral and political judgments. It's there to conduct itself as a business. I mean, that's what a business is supposed to be at the end of the day. I mean, obviously, you know, there are businesses which are media businesses, but Google has gone to extraordinary lengths to say that it is not one. So it was behaving in a completely illogical and non-business-like fashion. And I'm going to tell you something. I am absolutely sure that there were some shareholders who were concerned in exactly the way that you said, and who probably complained in exactly the way that you said. But the point is, the Google management paid no attention. And that's why, as night follows day, this has now come. This antitrust action has now come. And I predict with confidence that it will be the first of many. And I also predict that irrespective of what happens in the election, in which I should stress, I still fully expect Donald Trump to win. But even if he doesn't, by any conceivable chance, I still predict that the momentum for this now is so strong, it will continue and go forward. There may be attempts to slow the process down, but I think now the idea of an antitrust action against Google is out there, and I think it is going to happen. That's my prediction. That's what I expect, because the case for it is overwhelming. And Google itself, as all monopolies do, has made it. Microsoft made it before. And of course, going back in time, so did AT&T and so did Standard Oil.
Yeah, it's over. I agree. It doesn't matter who's who's in government, who has the Senate, who has the House. Mm. This is going to happen sooner or later. The antitrust lawsuit is going to go forward. I think it is an absolute slam dunk, even more of a slam dunk than Microsoft.
Yes.
You know, you have Trump now talking about taking a look at Section 230 and perhaps amending that. I haven't heard many people saying take it away, but I have heard different opinions in the Trump White House as far as perhaps maybe rewording it, maybe reestablishing its boundaries and what it permits and what it doesn't permit.
Yeah.
And I've also heard many people in the Trump White House talk about perhaps creating a way in which companies that are categorized under the Section 230 as a platform are punished or recategorized as a publisher if they do break the Section 230, the new, what they envision as the new Section 230 policy and standard. Google, for its part, will be broken up.
Yes.
I believe without a doubt, after looking at the lawsuit, that Android will become its own company.
Yes.
They're going to spin Android off.
Yes.
Because there's obviously a lot of concern with Google's dominance on the mobile device environment. Possibly YouTube could become its own company. And possibly that the advertising, the secret sauce to Google's success, which is the advertising platform, AdSense and AdWords, could very well be its own company. That could just be a company that multiple search engines could tap into in order to monetize their products. So you may be looking at three or four different companies being spun out of Google. And when they do hit Facebook, I have no doubt that spinning off WhatsApp, spinning off Instagram, and perhaps even spinning off Facebook's ad platform could be something that takes effect, in which case, that coupled with 230, looking at 230 and reexamining 230, could really just be the end of these big tech internet giants, and could really open the door to a whole different world on the internet. A lot of opportunity, maybe a lot of restrictions as well. YouTube may not be as profitable for creators as it once was, or AdWords and AdSense may not be as profitable for blogs as it once was. I don't know, but it's definitely going to create a different internet world.
Yes. Well, can we just talk about the breakup of Google in a moment? Because I find that very interesting. And as I said, you have a tech background, which I absolutely don't. And I'd like to try and discuss how that works. But I just want to say something quickly about articles, because I read it. And one of the things that really struck me about it is how incredibly vague the wording is. There is no real discussion within it of what the scope of this is. What happens if that provision is violated? How you abide by that provision? This cries out for much more clarity and particularity. Now, this is something I know lawyers talk about and do, and it can annoy and frustrate people. And they say, you know, we have one short paragraph and it does everything. And why do you need to have 50 pages of legislation? Well, if you don't have those 50 pages of legislation, we've set out clear rules and guidelines and red lines and things like that, then I'm afraid provisions like that become themselves open to abuse. And actually, I have to say, I was quite astonished to see how vague and imprecise this provision was. And I would be extremely curious to go back in time, look at the congressional debates, find out how it happened, because I can't help but think that this must have been slipped in and perhaps some kind of lobbying from somewhere was behind it, because it doesn't even read very clearly itself. So, you know, it cries out for reform. It cries out for further elaboration. You've got to say, well, you know, if you're going to benefit from this provision, then you need to do this, that, the other. And these are the things you cannot do. And these are the consequences if you breach these provisions. And this is how they're enforced. And it should even, in my opinion, provide a mechanism for people who feel that this provision is not being abided by to take steps, perhaps to contact the Justice Department, to do whatever. So that there is actually some teeth to this. Because as it stands at the moment, there is none.
But I have a question. You don't want to regulate something too much. I don't want to use the word regulate, because I'm not in favor of regulation.
No, I agree with that.
In this instance.
I agree with that.
But you don't want to make it too difficult too many fences to jump, because then it's very difficult for, say, that two-person startup, garage to create the next Google, Facebook, or Twitter as well. So you want to make sure that you can keep these big, powerful companies in check.
Yeah, check.
But you don't make it too difficult for competition to start up and ramp up and get big. Yeah.
The whole purpose of good competition is to foster competition and entrepreneurial activity. If it doesn't do that, then it's failing. Then it can become a bureaucratic nightmare. Which, by the way, it often does. I mean, that's the other extreme. And by the way, the Europeans especially are notorious at this. And if you want to know one reason, in my opinion, why Germany, for example, has failed completely to develop its own tech sector to anything like the extent that one would expect it to have done, given the enormous depth of engineering and technical resources that exist in Germany, it is because regulation there is completely out of control. Clearly, there is a balance to be struck. But I'm going to say something that is the genius of the United States. Historically, it's always known how to do this. It's known how to do this in a way that protects the consumer and at the same time fosters the entrepreneur. This provision, as it exists at the moment, is dangerous, because when you have it in conditions where certain tech giants have achieved a monopoly, it gives them a blank check to do anything. And that's what you mustn't do either. So you are absolutely right. We don't want something that's going to be very complicated, the kind of regime that is, you know, impossible and unendurable, that will close down, you know, the two people in the garage who are basically setting up their own search engine, their own platform, working in that direction. You certainly don't want to do that. But what you want to do well is you need to give those sort of guys a clear idea of, you know, how they can go about setting up their business, and at the same time protect them from the other big guys who will try to stifle them. As I said, that is what good regulation does. I'm talking as a lawyer. I used to do lots of competition work, so you know I know where off I am speaking here. And this, as I said, is something that the British should go at. It is something the US historically has been outstanding at. The alternative, of course, is to have no Section 230 type protections at all. I think that would be extremely difficult for small companies. So you need certain protections. You need certain things to keep this thing in check. And at the same time, you mustn't allow these, you know, overpowerful companies to emerge. These, as we say in England, overmighty subjects that are more powerful than the US government itself. And in fact, basically try to take control of the government by behaving in the kind of way we've seen in the election. So I hope I've said it reasonably.
Yeah, well, I'll add a further point, which you can go into.
Yeah.
We never had this problem until these companies really did become too big. I mean, you know, YouTube and Facebook, you never had a problem posting stuff until they got so massive.
Yeah.
That's point number one. But point number two is you also have to take a look at their collusion as well. And I think this is a big problem that I think the Justice Department has to look at, in that they have to set Section 230 or set the rules of the game so that if for some reason I post something, I'll give an example. If I post something on YouTube, which rightly so requires that that post gets removed or blocked, say that YouTube is in the right in this case, you have to make it so that, or even in the wrong, it doesn't matter. You have to make it so that these companies don't also collude amongst each other to remove me from various other platforms, even though, say, I didn't post on Twitter or something, which is what we've seen. We've seen someone do something on one platform, Twitter, and then get banned on all the platforms literally within the same day, which means that there is some sort of communication and collusion. And to take it even further, we've seen these companies leverage their power to get companies erased from host providers, which is the basic infrastructure of the internet. If you don't have a host, then you can't even show up. We've seen them influence payment processors, so companies can't even process the payments for the sale of their goods and services. You know, we've seen companies have to take their products overseas to host in Russia, so that they can be hosted somewhere, so that they can have some sort of company that'll process their visas and their MasterCards and their payment services. We've seen PayPal deplatform people because of what YouTube did. So I think the Justice Department has to, okay, focus on YouTube, but there's a bigger issue here that they have to take a look at things with regards to Section 230 and big tech and say, you know what? We need to figure out a legal mechanism so that we don't have companies in the same space colluding, but we also don't have these big tech companies forcing or influencing payment processors and host providers from also taking action against customers.
Exactly. Well, you see, the key point about this is what you're basically describing there is a form of cartel. It's a cartel, you know, people, big tech companies coming together, working together as a group, both to secure their own positions and to influence whatever it is that they want to influence. And of course, cartels, can I stress, are something that the United States and its economic system has historically been extremely hostile to. It has always aimed to break them up. So has Britain, by the way. The Germans, by contrast, historically and traditionally, tended to favor cartels. But the US system was to break up cartels and to consider cartels, in effect, dare I say it, kinds of conspiracies. I mean, there's that famous phrase from Adam Smith, you know, in Wealth of Nations, that, you know, business people in a certain field only need to come together socially for them to engage in a conspiracy against the public. It's actually there. It's that actual phrase is in the Wealth of Nations. And he made it very clear that that is completely wrong and inappropriate in a properly functioning business system. And that has always been, as I said, the pattern and tradition in the United States. And you're absolutely right. I mean, these activities, these cartels, this cartel that we're seeing, or big tech, has been incredibly destructive. But cartels can only function when the members of the cartel are, in effect, in a monopoly position. So you have to have Google, occupying the massive space that it does. You have to have Facebook doing the same. You have to have Twitter doing the same, so that they can all work in unison and then intimidate and bully everyone else, you know, PayPal and all,
Visa, MasterCard.
Exactly, all those people into submitting to whatever decision they have made. A cartel only works in conditions of monopoly, and monopoly ought to provoke an antitrust type of response. So all these things are connected. And if the United States, the Justice Department, actually moves ahead with this, which I am absolutely so sure now it will, we will see all of this, all of these terrible practices end. And as you correctly say, we will see a new internet world. Now, it'll be different from the one we know. It will pose its own challenges, because clearly, you know, it will not be quite as straightforward in some ways to go and post on one platform if there's just many. One might have to sort of think things differently and structure things differently. But in some ways, I mean, from a legal point of view, from a competition lawyer's point of view, it's still a healthier system than this extraordinary concentration of a few companies that, you know, form an overmighty and overpowerful position. It's not a coincidence. And, you know, we might want to talk about this more in another program, perhaps. But it's not a coincidence that the events of the last 2 weeks in the election have provoked some academics of a certain political view to talk about actually introducing into the United States the kind of controls that exist in China. Because through monopolies, that becomes possible. The whole point of not having monopolies is to make that kind of thing impossible. And that is the American way.
Yeah, I think that is the larger picture here is the reason you'll see a lot of these academics and some Democrats and maybe some people in running for Senate, or maybe even from the Democrat Party itself, the Democrat candidate. The reason you'll see them want these monopolies to stick around is because for the time being, they think that these monopolies are siding with them. They are, but they think that they'll protect them, or they think that they'll work for them. But what usually will happen is that the Googles and the Facebooks and the Twitter, once they get their way and they have solidified their position and there are no more competitors there and there's no one that can touch them, well, they're just going to do away with all these people. You know, people can refer to the Yuri Bezmenov videos where, you know, he's exactly right. Once the communists take over and they have their useful idiots who took them to this position, the academics, the foot soldiers, the politicians, the first thing they do is they get rid of them.
Well, they don't need them anymore. So, I mean, you know, they're at that point, they can just carry on because, you know, they don't need these people anymore. And, you know, they obviously have their own views and ultimately their own interests, which may not be identical always to those people. I think people on the left, because, of course, we're talking ultimately on the left, need to understand that. I mean, this is a tiger that they're riding and their tigers can turn on you. But anyway, that may be something we want to discuss in more detail. I was just wondering how, because obviously your background is in tech, which mine isn't, how you imagine all of these different companies, you know, relating to each other. Because one of the other things with breaking up monopolies and the breakup of Standard Oil, the great company that Rockefeller created, the oil company, which was the dominant oil company in the United States, is that it was all broken up into various component parts, but it was pretty well known for decades that those various component parts colluded with each other. So you had Standard Oil of New Jersey, Exxon, as it's known, and it works alongside, you know, Mobil and SoCal, Standard Oil of California. And they were all, in fact, even though they were nominally separate companies, they were still acting in all kinds of collusive ways. So, you know, having said that, they were all oil companies. So the question is, would companies like, say, you know, WhatsApp, if it's, you know, hived off from Facebook, or YouTube, if it's hived off from Google, and I agree, these are obvious separations. How, I mean, would they actually be sustainable by themselves? I think they would be. I can't see what.
That's a good question. Greg,
yeah.
That's a hard question to answer. I mean, yeah WhatsApp definitely has the customer base. I mean, it definitely has the users, no doubt about it. But up until this point, it hasn't had to worry about monetization. So it can be completely focused on the product and making the product, you know, optimal without having to think about how do I monetize it, which is if you take something like Viber, which isn't, you know, doesn't have, you know, Facebook subsidizing them, which is what WhatsApp has. It's basically Facebook just subsidizes WhatsApp. It takes whatever data it can from WhatsApp and integrates it into their platform and their advertising platform and their monetization system. But, you know, WhatsApp hasn't had to bake in monetization tools. And many times those monetization tools interfere with the customer experience. So you go onto Viber and you have the same messaging app in essence as WhatsApp, but in between the messages, you may have ads or they may try to push you to buy stickers or push you to buy emojis because they have to make money. WhatsApp doesn't have to worry about that. No. They can have a clean interface, a clean product, and that's that. You know, it's like watching a TV show, watching a TV channel and having zero advertisements on it. Zero, because you know, the parent company takes care of it and that's that. While, you know, your standard television shows have to put ads in between them or whatever. It's, you know, they're going to have to start thinking about that. Is it sustainable? That's a good question. If they could shift gears, splitting the companies is going to be a piece of cake. A couple of lines of code. I don't want to trivialize it, but it's going to be very easy.
Yeah.
You split them apart, but they're going to have to start thinking about making revenue. The same for YouTube. No one knows if YouTube is sustainable to date. A lot of people say that YouTube, if it was its own company, would be bleeding money.
Yeah.
It would have to figure out a way. And one of the ways that YouTube may have to think about, you know, being sustainable is saying, you know what, we can't kick off everybody. We have to keep people around to create content and monetize that content. Of course, they could go the reverse direction and say, we're just going to be like Netflix. I don't know. But they're going to have to start making those decisions if they don't have a company like Google subsidizing them.
Yes.
Yeah, they're going to have to start thinking like a business, and their managers are going to have to start acting like managers and not like ideologues.
Yes.
Absolutely. And that I'm for. Absolutely. Because the small entrepreneur has to do the same thing. We have to think about how are we going to make money.
Exactly.
You know, people tell us, oh, you know, you guys are funded. What do we hear all the time? You're funded by the Kremlin or stuff, which is just absolute nonsense. It's ridiculous.
Yes.
It's absolutely ridiculous. Yes. We have to figure out ways to feed ourselves and keep this business going. We have to sell t-shirts. We have to sell merchandise. We have to create ebooks or Patreon or Subscribestar. And we run a business. This channel is very much, we have to think about our business and our product and all these things. Mm. It would be great if we could do a video, Alexander, and just not talk at all about anything. You know, just do the video, end it, and then be on our way because we have some patron who says, here you go. Here's, you know, your money for the day and see you later. But we don't have that luxury and we depend on our viewers and we're very thankful. So, yeah, I mean, I think this is such a legal question. I think the mechanics are very simple, to be honest. There's a business end that they're going to have to, these companies, when they do get split, they're going to have to think about, no doubt about it. And that's a good thing. Get all these ideologues out of there and start thinking in a business standpoint. But this is, without a doubt, they need to figure out how to create this ecosystem from a legal standpoint. That I don't know how they're going to do it. People talk regulation. People say Section 230. People say categorize them as publishers, not platforms. No. People, libertarians, say don't do anything.
Yes,
just
I know.
Keep, you know, the market open.
Yeah. Well, can I just say one of the things about the present system is that, dare I put it in this way, it is very centralized and almost in a kind of Soviet fashion, socialistic. You can provide certain aspects which then go and cross-subsidize others, and you don't have to worry about everything actually being profitable. And in a way, that kind of very centralized socialistic, centrally planned control, planned system lends itself to extraordinary degrees of control, but it also does something else. It causes stagnation. It in the end, it drains the system of its dynamism, because you don't ultimately, when you have a monopoly type situation, you don't have to think about the customer. You don't have to think about how you're selling your whatever it is you're selling. And you don't really worry so much beyond a certain point about your technology, because if your existing technology is sufficient for you and you're making huge profits as a result of it, well, you don't really have the incentive really to change it. So things start to lose dynamism and energy and they begin to slow down. And I know this isn't something that many people would agree with, but I think this has been happening actually for some time now. I think there was a time in the 90s and early 2000s when Silicon Valley was producing extraordinary new products and new ideas all the time. And it was brimming with energy and activity. And that has now slowed down to a marked degree, which is a product, as I said, of increasing cartelization and monopolization. And I am not sure, this is my own personal view, I am not sure that it is providing the kind of service that to its viewers and its customers and its various people who plug into it that is needed anymore. That it's really, in some ways, like what it was, it's geared to a world that is perhaps a decade old.
Yeah, I agree with that. And actually on that point, and maybe we could wrap it up here and get your thoughts.
Yeah.
On that point, how much of this do you think actually is due to physical location? I've lived in Silicon Valley. The collusion and this cartel atmosphere can also be a factor that all these people, the Googles, the Apples, the Facebooks, they're literally within a 30-mile radius of each other. They're sharing employees. One employee goes from there to the other company. Yeah. They're going to the same restaurants. They go to the same cafes. They share homes together. You're talking really about an ecosystem within a 30-mile radius. And it's not only the companies that I think the Department of Justice has to look at, they also have to look at the way it's financed, because not only do you have the companies in this ecosystem, you have the venture capitalists in the same Silicon Valley ecosystem.
Yes.
So maybe the government has to start to think about ways to say, you know what, these venture capital companies, which are essentially getting their funding from pension funds for the most part, the limited partners are getting a lot of the money that they invest in these companies from the venture funds, which is the U.S. taxpayer and the American people. Maybe we need to figure out ways to get these venture capital companies outside of the valley and into other areas of the United States.
Absolutely.
To break apart this actual physical ecosystem that is leading to all of this, to this cartel and this collusion.
Yes. Can I there's been sociological studies about this. When you have an entire ecosystem physically located in one place, then it reproduces culturally itself. So what you will find is that everybody who's part of it is essentially a copy of everyone else. They will have the same opinions. They will go to the same kind of restaurants. They will wear the same sort of clothes. They will own the same sort of apartments. They will own the same types of cars. And they will all think in the same way. And that is, again, a very, very, very bad thing, ultimately, if you want a diverse and energetic and dynamic sector. Whereas if you had it dispersed across the United States, so that you had, sort of Silicon Valleys or their equivalent in New York and New England and in the South, in the Midwest, you would have a completely different culture there, and they would all interconnect with each other, and there would be a totally different world and a different way of thinking. And that would be that would ultimately be a good thing, actually. It would make for a far more interesting, this is my own view, a far more interesting world than one, as I said, where it's just basically the same types of people. Because, you see, they will recruit always the same sort of people to their various firms. They will always go for someone who is like themselves, because that's what companies tend to do. They always tend to do that. They don't look for people who are different, because, well, why would they? So that's actually a very, very important point.
Yeah, absolutely. And the people that give them the money, the venture capitalists that give them the money, you know, they'd much prefer to give money to an entrepreneur that used to work at Google, who they know, than to some guy, you know, from Indiana, who may have a better product, may be smarter, may have a better idea, may have a better marketing plan, better monetization. Mm. But, you know, the venture capitalist says, I don't know this guy. He's not in the ecosystem. No one can tell me about him. He wasn't working at Google, and I know his manager or her manager, blah, blah, blah. And you know, you're really doing a disservice to the entire, you know, U.S. ecosystem, the entire entrepreneurship of the U.S. by doing that. So you have to figure out a way to somehow get the money dispersed.
Well, exactly.
It's so concentrated right now. It's all on Sand Hill Road. It's like literally on one road.
Exactly. So you have the philosophy of Sand Hill Road being imposed on the entire United States, even though the United States is an incredibly diverse place. And can I just say, if you go back to the economic history of the United States, which, by the way, I should say, I was always very interested in that sort of thing. One of the great things about the United States in the late 1930s, 20th century, was that the economy was incredibly diverse, and it was very decentralized. It was very regional. So you had a distinct economy in the Midwest, for example. You had, around the Great Lakes, you had one type of culture there, another one in the West itself, in California, New York, New England. They were all very different, but they were all operating together as part of this, you know, huge country, and each part of it would sort of play off the strengths of the other, and that created extraordinary synergies. Whereas if you sort of focus it in one place along one street, well, then it loses that precise quality, which is one of the things that made the United States the economic superpower that it eventually became.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there. And I think this is a good thing.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's inevitable at this point in time.
It's inevitable, and it is a good thing. I mean, you know, there may be some, you know, difficult transitions, but it is a very, very good thing.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there. And as we said in the video, guys, we're not supported by anybody except our merchandise and our business model, which is, of course, delivering the news to you guys, which we take a great pleasure in. And hoping that you like our merchandise, or that you subscribe to us on PayPal and Patreon. And indeed, look for us on Odyssey and BitChute, by the way.
Indeed. And just to remind you what our wonderful merchandise is, we have our magic mugs, this one with the flag of the United States, our wonderful magic mugs, the best magic mugs in the world. We have our amazing T-shirts. We've got long-sleeved and short-sleeved T-shirts, and we've got polo shirts. And you can see that has the flag of the United Kingdom, the country of which I am a citizen. Oh, gosh. And there's Alex. I'm not sure what that flag is, Alex. Perhaps you can
see it. No, Serbia.
Yeah, I can see it. It's Serbia. And here is also Britain on my on this hat that I'm wearing. We've got amazing hats. You can see it close, hopefully a bit closer there, the Union Jack. And you can see that it's beautifully embroidered. It's beautifully made. We've got both truckers' hats and baseball hats, and we've also got hoodies, and we've got amazing ebooks. Come to our shop, you can buy these amazing things, you'll become the proud owner, and at the same time, you will be supporting the Durand. So please come to our shop and support us, and we are, as we said, very grateful for it. And can I just again repeat what Alex said? We are purely a business. We are not resourced or funded by any great mysterious patron out there who is giving us all the support we need. That isn't how we function at all.
Yeah, and while we're at it, let's do a plug for Patriotic Legacy as well, because that is another great entrepreneurial company. Great entrepreneurs at Patriotic Legacy. As Alex reaches for his Patriotic Beacon, there is a contest where you can win a shirt, a Durant shirt, not this one, but a black Durant shirt with the logo embroidered right across here, printed right across the chest area. Yeah. And you also, of course, could win the Patriotic Beacon. The black one that Alexander is holding right there. Use the code Durant20 to enter the contest and you get 20% off. So that is the contest from our friends at the Patriotic Legacy, who make the best flashlight torch in the world. Another great American entrepreneur.
Absolutely. A great American entrepreneur, a great American product, the best flashlight in the world, solar powered, extraordinarily strong, beautiful to hold, with all kinds of different things that it can do. It could be a tool. It can cut you out of your car. It's got a compass, so if you get lost, you can get your compass bearings. It's got an alarm, so you can call your dog, which is what I do, or alert people to where you are. And of course, it's got this tremendously powerful light, which you can see, and you can also have it flashing. So it ships all over the world. It's the Patriot Beacon, made by our friends at the Patriotic Legacy in the United States, the best flashlight in the world. So join this competition and get yourself one. You will be absolutely thrilled. And when you have it in your hands, you will have one of those great quality American products.
All right. Alexander Mercuris, thank you very much. Take care, everybody. You'll find all the links underneath this video in the description box down below. Take care.